When was your last checkup? No, not you. Although that's important, too. But when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Chevy Drive Chicago. Schedule a service appointment at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on books. So if you were to list the most important years in the formation of American independence, 1721 might not be in your top five, but maybe it should be. Stephen Koss has written The Fever of 1721, an account of U.S. history that includes rebellion, of free press, and science and religion all in one year, the year 1721. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so is it true the book idea came to you from a fact of the day calendar?
That's absolutely true, and it was way back in 1993. What happened was at Christmas time, my wife and kids gave me a little stocking stuffer, and it was a fact of day calendar.
Sure, right.
And I was thumbing through it, and I happened upon this fact that on June 26, 1721, a doctor named Boylston conducted the first inoculation experiment in Western medicine. That it was very controversial, his life was in danger, and most surprisingly to me of all, it was Cotton Mather, who I always associated with the Salem witch trials,
right.
who suggested trying it. And so I was hooked, and I wrote a screenplay based on that and eventually the book.
So is the screenplay still alive?
I mean, it was alive in a drawer.
It was dormant for a while, but now with the book, maybe it'll come back.
It might. And people are saying, maybe they say this about every book, people say it does seem to have movie potential. But yeah, I put it in a drawer for 10 years and took it out at the advice of a friend who heard the story and said, you need to write that as a full book.
All right, let's start with the science part of it here. Smallpox at the time was a fact of life in the 18th century. And I did not know, but it was almost on the schedule, right? It would come back every, 12 years or so?
Yeah.
Boston at this time in 1721 was long overdue, and that made it rife for trouble. Tell me about that.
It did. As you said, I mean, it worked out that about every 12 years, a new smallpox epidemic would strike Boston. And that was a function of a bunch of different things, including the number of people who had been born in the interim and so were therefore susceptible to the epidemic.
Because younger people were more susceptible.
Exactly. Yeah. And it tended to strike them harder and be more deadly for young and old people. And what happened in this case was, for reasons we don't entirely understand, it didn't hit after 12 years. It went almost twice that long, so that there were many, many more people susceptible to it by the time it did hit.
I mean, not to compare death to a forest fire, but in a way, I mean, the brush had grown up and was just rife for danger.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so here comes the HMS Seahorse into port. And they knew they had someone on board who was infected, didn't they?
Yeah, they had. The Seahorse was accompanying merchant ships down to the Caribbean. And in Barbados, it had encountered a really bad smallpox epidemic. And we know from the ship's records, the records that exist, that people died, sailors died on the way back, although the captain was very careful not to say why they died.
Right.
And that was characteristic of him. He was fairly imperious and not really concerned with the well-being of the general population. So when he got back to Boston, he, of course, was anxious to get his ship back into port and go on with business. And in fact, there were a number of people who had died along the way and were still sick on board, and those sailors began to come into Boston.
So it's in his very selfish interest to hide this, to come on board, unload his gear and move on, I guess.
Very much so.
And so the smallpox is back. And then here comes Cotton Mather. And this is fascinating to me because, you know, we think of modern day, in some cases, modern day religion or preachers sort of being anti-science or not as friendly to science. Mather, this guy who presided over the Salem witch trials, now is a champion of this odd sort of inoculation idea. It was new to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as I said, that was the thing that really got me, because I had the same idea of Cotton Mather everybody does.
Sure.
This is the bad guy of the Salem witch trials. This
Fire and brimstone.
Yeah, superstitious guy. You know, in fact, he was in a Spider-Man comic book in 1976 as a villain. The only other real historical character to get that distinction, quote unquote, was Adolf Hitler.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he's an archetypal American villain, and yet, like most Puritans, he was very interested in learning. They were very obsessed with learning and education. And so he had been studying all along, and he came across this inoculation, which no one had heard of, actually twice within a six-month period in 1716. He kept it secret to himself, and then when smallpox came, he told the doctors.
It came out of Africa? The inoculation idea?
Yeah, well, inoculation, no one knows exactly where it started. We know that it had been practiced in Africa for at least several decades mm-hmm. before 1721, and we're pretty sure it was much longer in China and elsewhere in the world.
I just like that because we're so Western-centric so many times that this wonderful thing comes from Africa, somewhere where we might not have thought of it.
Yeah, and that's what happened then as well. People were so Western-centric that they refused to pay attention.
And so Mather's got this idea. He thinks it might help. We've got this population so susceptible, the forest fire I'd compared it to. He's got to find someone willing to try it, and he can't, or he has a hard time.
Right.
He finds this guy, Boylston, who is sort of a second-rate surgeon in Boston. Yep. Tell me how that went.
Yeah, Boylston's a fascinating case. Boylston had smallpox in the last epidemic in 1702 and nearly died. So he had a lot of personal experience and with how terrible it could be. He had six children who were susceptible to it. But what made him different from everybody else who had those same kinds of circumstances was that in his training, in his upbringing, his father, who had also been a doctor, spent a lot of time in the countryside outside of Boston interacting with the Native Americans. So he had a lot of Native American medicine just automatically accepted that into his physic.
Mm-hmm.
So when Cotton Mather came along and said, we've got this strange procedure from Constantinople and Africa, he was more inclined to pay attention than anybody else.
And so tell me about the actual procedure, because, again, we think of it as fairly commonplace now, or absolutely commonplace. Then not only was it revolutionary, it was, well, by our view anyway, pretty primitive.
Yes.
How would they do it?
Yes, inoculation was pre-vaccination. So this was literally taking smallpox pus from someone who had the disease and implanting that pus in an incision made in the arm of a healthy person who had never had smallpox. And what would happen was you would get a small, minor, hopefully harmless case of smallpox, which you would survive and then therefore become immune.
Boylston believes. And so then he turns to his son, right? Mm-hmm. He inoculates his son, his own son, first.
Right.
And it didn't go so well.
No, it was probably for Boylston, it was the low point of the whole thing. Boylston's six-year-old son was one of his first three patients in the inoculation trial, and he felt he needed to inoculate his son because he couldn't ask everybody else to do it if he didn't believe enough in it to do it with his own son. His son did get sick, and there were more sick than anybody had led him to believe might happen.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, more sick than a lot of people who would follow. But he did recover. It didn't really matter because people were so outraged that he had done this to his son that the fact that the boy recovered was almost secondary.
So we start with Mather. We've got Boylston. And now we turn to this guy, James Franklin, the older brother of Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin is there as well, working as an apprentice to James Franklin, who starts a newspaper and is incensed by the fact that Boylston inoculates his own son and it doesn't go well, right? They rail. Here we've got the media railing against the science in a way.
That's right. That's right. And James Franklin had two partners who were true believers in the anti-inoculation cause. James Franklin was a strange case because he was more opportunistic. He wanted to start a newspaper. And Boston had two papers, and everybody said it can't tolerate a third. Nobody will read it. But he was determined. And when this inoculation controversy created all this interest and uproar and buzz, he jumped in and he said, I'm going to start a newspaper based on this.
Right.
So, in fact, the paper was anti-inoculation, but whether he was is a little harder to tell because he never wrote it against it personally.
Well, tell me about that then. So the paper, so was he doing it just to sell papers?
I think the way I see it is he looked at the inoculation controversy as his opening, his way to get into the newspaper business.
I see.
And then, you know, that meant being on the side of the people who would buy the most papers, and they were against inoculation.
So Fox News or MSNBC?
It has overtones of common day, of contemporary day life.
Yeah. Well, but the other thing was that, and the reason this year is so fascinating is it was a first in that it was an independent newspaper.
Right.
He was telling things to people that the government didn't want them to know, how bad this smallpox outbreak really was.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and James, you know, in his defense, the paper was had about four issues that were stridently anti-inoculation. And then he essentially fired the other two guys, his partners.
Okay.
He took over and sort of took a different turn entirely. And the paper still came out strongly against things it didn't like, but it had more to do with the government now, and it had to do with more a general sort of skepticism about how much power the clergy had in Boston, things that nobody had ever dared say before.
Ben Franklin is there, and actually fills in for his brother when James is thrown into jail.
Right.
You said that Franklin learned everything in 1721 that he would really need to know.
Right.
And he became, from 1721, then one of our great founding fathers. Elisha Cook. The next name then, and I'm interested in this because it's come up a few times now in my readings, things that we take for granted now that is, it's like, well, why wouldn't they have always done it this way, but turned out to be new. Cook was this government opponent, right? Mm-hmm. And hadn't really until that time, the idea of marshaling the masses mm-hmm. against the powers that be was a new idea. It
yeah.
seems so old and natural to us now, but
right.
Cook capitalized on that. Explain that for me.
He did. I mean, politics until 1721 was sort of a club activity. So the people who had all the money, the sort of the old money in Boston and Massachusetts, including Cook, because he was one of the old money people, they ran the show. And he realized when he decided he wanted to marshal support against the royal government, because he was the first, I call him our founding grandfather. He was very opposed to English, England imposing its will on.
You can trace him to Sam Adams later.
Exactly. There was a direct connection. But Cook realized that if he got a bunch of people to vote, a bunch of people who were eligible to vote but never did, that he could actually wield incredible power, and he did.
He did. Samuel Chute was the governor at the time, so he was Cook's sort of chief nemesis.
Right.
Chute was Cook's target. We talk about rough politics now, and here we are in Chicago where there have been some theatrics. Chute calls the representatives, the representatives of the government into session, and these would be sort of Cook's people, right?
Exactly.
Calls them into session in a location where he knows they're going to get smallpox.
That's right.
That's unimaginable.
Yeah, he was so desperate. I mean, this is a sign of how effective Cook's organization, which became known as the Boston Caucus and went on to become a factor in the revolution. He was so successful, Cook was, between 1719 and 1721, that Chute realized he was about to be recalled by England because he was losing control. Mm. He was losing control of the colony. And so in a really desperate move, he basically took the House of Representatives hostage in a, as you say, a smallpox-infected part of town, and basically said, I'll let you go home when you agree to do what I want to do. And they did not do that.
And someone died.
Correct.
It did shoot in as well.
That did. I think, you know, public sentiment was turning against him, but when he did that, and one of the most beloved legislators in Massachusetts was the victim of smallpox because of that, he was a lame duck. He was there. He stayed for about another year, but he was totally ineffective.
All right. So we've got we've got religion and science. We've got a free press. We've got political instigators and all of that. That's 1721. How does that play in 2016? I mean, is there something from then that we can take to now?
I think there are a lot of things. It's funny because when I wrote the book, I didn't try to make too many connections to the present, but people are finding them, and I'm gratified by that because I think there are. I mean, certainly political dysfunction was rife in Boston in 1721, and you see the downside of that because part of the reason smallpox got into Boston was the politicians were so busy fighting with each other and so busy worrying about their other priorities that they weren't paying attention to protecting the population. And I think we come close to that situation sometimes, too, in a place like Flint, for example, Flint, Michigan.
Right, right.
Not always just infectious disease. And certainly in terms of, I think it has ramifications for the press and what the press needs to do these days, maybe versus what it's doing.
Right.
Two other newspapers in Boston printed what the government wanted to hear. James Franklin wouldn't do that. And then just the move towards revolution and understanding sort of how that happens. And that's an ongoing process, too, I guess.
Stephen Koss is the author of The Fever of 1721, The Epidemic That Revolutionized Medicine and American Politics. It was great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books.